You are listening to a free version of the Majority Report with Sam Steeder. To support this show and get another 15 minutes of daily program, go to majority.fm, please.
It is Monday, February 22nd, 2021. My name is Sam Steeder. This is the five-time award-winning Majority Report. We are broadcasting live steps and steps from the industrially ravaged Gowanus Canal in the heartland of America, downtown Brooklyn, USA. On the program today, Naomi Klein, author of How to Change Everything, The Young Human's Guide to Protecting the Planet and Each Other, and Why Texas Republicans Fear the New Green Deal. Meanwhile, the U.S. at 500,000 COVID deaths as infections and hospitalizations slow. The Supreme Court just declined to block the Manhattan DA's grand jury from getting 8 years of Donald Trump's tax returns. Meanwhile, demands grow for Texas energy debt forgiveness. Susan Collins to join Joe Manchin in opposing Neera Tanden's nomination to the Office of Management and Budget. House, meanwhile, is on track to pass $1.9 trillion COVID relief later this week. Amazon reportedly offering net resignation bonuses to stop union organizing in Alabama. Trump looking forward to CPAC this weekend, where he will announce that he, the presumptive Republican nominee in 2024. Meanwhile, Dominion Voting files a $1.3 billion defamation suit versus the MyPillow guy. A deathbed letter claims that the NYPD and FBI were involved in Malcolm X's assassination. And lastly, the Lincoln Project completely implodes. All this and more on today's program. Welcome, ladies and gentlemen. Joining me, as always, Emma Vigeland. And Emma, of course, last week, I was not joining you, and I have received nothing but rave reviews on your helming the ship solo. So thank you very much for holding down the fort last week.
Well, that's very kind of you, Sam, and viewers. It was really a lot of fun, and I got to do my own thing, you know, tear the place down, so to speak.
Well, I'm a little bit concerned about what's going on in the studio, but with all that said, we will endeavor to persevere on that. Meanwhile, let's get to one of the things. Obviously, I missed last week was this horrible situation in Texas, where the power grid had failed essentially in multiple ways. Leaving people without electricity in very cold weather. We don't know any numbers right now in terms of deaths, or I should say we don't know any final count. Just a horrific situation. And we'll be talking to Naomi Klein about the reaction to it. But here is a prime example. And it's fascinating. It really is fascinating to see how coordinated this message was and how quickly it was deployed. And we will talk to Naomi Klein about the implications of it. But here's Ron Johnson on Fox Business News with Maria Bartiromo. Here he is on Sunday, yesterday.
What we saw in Texas certainly shows what folly the Green New Deal would be, how unreliable wind and solar power generation really is, and how it needs fossil fuel backup. We've also learned how vulnerable our grid is to, again, the unreliable green energy, but also potentially to geomagnetic disturbance from the sun, you know, solar winds, and also potentially EMP attacks. So,
you know, it's interesting. If you were to take Ron Johnson literally, you would assume that something like 80% of the energy that Texas relies on comes from wind and solar, and 20% comes from fossil fuels. In fact, it's the opposite. But the real problem, of course, we know, is there was a complete lack of regulation. The state deregulated decades ago, and was, or I should say, a couple about 20 years ago, a little less, and or more, I should say, decades ago.
Well, basically, and they created their own system to skirt federal regulation in the 30s by not making it cross state lines. So they had complete jurisdiction over it, which allowed them to cut corners. And again, you point out that small figure of wind turbines. If they had regulation, or if it wasn't such a profit motive, they could have had technology that would defreeze wind turbines, even if, you know,
of
that
course
was the primary source, which it's not, obviously.
Of course. The under regulation, they would be required to expend money on things that they may not use every day. So much of this, and we talk about this with Naomi Klein, so much of this reminds me of Katrina, where the buses that they had, that FEMA had standing by ostensibly to evacuate people from New Orleans, they had outsourced it. They had privatized this to a contractor who then subcontracted. And the buses could have been waiting outside the city. They were about an hour and a half away. They could have been waiting outside the city for the go. But instead of doing that, because what if they didn't need them? Then that would cut into their profit margin. This is exactly the same type of dynamic.
And we're seeing it in COVID too, you know, with the for-profit hospitals. They don't have the capacity because
that would have
cut into their profit margins.
Exactly. Can't have any empty beds during the course of normal things because that would inhibit our profit. If we were to have those extra beds in the case of an emergency or a spike or high, low temperatures. Well, you know, and they know they will get away with this. This is just simply the way that they do business and they make money. We're going to take a quick break. When we return, we'll be talking to Naomi Klein back in just a moment. Hey, folks, a couple of words from our sponsors. First, Hunt-A-Killer. The murder mystery subscription box. That's the most exciting date night you can do at home. Now, Matt and his girlfriend have been doing this apparently. And he did the same one that I did, which was curtain call. And well, first off, let me just explain what Hunt-A-Killer is. It is essentially a whodunit game. You can do this with people who are physically present with you. You could do it with them, via Zoom. You could do it at your own pace, two different people working on it. You decode ciphers, you examine clues, you solve puzzles. And what happens is they deliver you something every month. You can also speed it up if you want. Some people can't wait. You get documents, you get evidence, you get audio recordings, you get case files, you eliminate suspects, you identify murder weapons, you crack the case, you catch the killer. You can even, like I say, you can get on Zoom. Mix it in with your drinking, your Zoom cocktail hours or whatever you people are doing these days. I have no idea. But for me, it's been a fun thing to do with my teen daughter because it's one way to get her. It's really, so far, probably the only way that I have found to get her off her screen devices. I guess there's some activities that she does that are not on the screen, to be fair.
Yeah.
But Hunt-A-Killer has 100,000 active subscribers. They have over 2,000 five-star reviews. Part of the proceeds for every box goes to a Cold Case Foundation, an organization dedicated to helping with real-life cold cases. In fact, that's what Curtain Call is about. this woman found a basically a mummified body. And it was, she was an actress. This is all fictional, incidentally. But it's set. You go back in time, essentially, to solve the case like you would if you were trying to solve a case from the 1930s. And it's a good pretense to, you know, give my child some history. And it's fun. So it's fun to do for date night, fun to do with your kids, older kids. I wouldn't do this with a seven-year-old, but it's because it's also hard. Right now, you can go to huntakiller.com/majority. Use the promo code majority. Get 20% off your first box. Again, use the code majority. You get 20% off. Find out if you have what it takes to hunt a killer. This is funny because I was thinking about this the other day. We're about to change seasons, hopefully, as it snows outside right now. But if you want to make a change this season, Stitch Fix can help you choose new pieces you love. I've got to do this because, I'll say it in a second. But what Stitch Fix is they offer clothing. It's hand-selected by expert stylists. They pick it out based upon your unique size, your unique style, your budget. It's the easy solution to finding what makes you look and feel your best. You try on pieces at home before you buy. You keep your favorites. You send back the rest. You pay just a $20 styling fee for each box. They send you a box full of different articles of clothing. And that gets credited towards any of the pieces you keep. There's no subscription required. You try Stitch Fix once, or you can set up automatic deliveries. Shipping, returns, exchanges, super easy, super free. Well, just free. I don't know what super free means. But a prepaid return envelope is included in your Stitch Fix box. Super easy to return. Stitch Fix has styles and clothing for women, men, and kids. They ship all over the U.S., and they're available in the U.K. as well. So check it out. For me, this is what's interesting. So I got these Chukka boots, and I think I got it like literally a year ago today. I don't know if it was today, but it was around now. It's February. And I got the Chukka boots, and I was super excited. And I was going to, wear them out on town. And I've worn them, but like I'm not going out on the town because of the pandemic. And I got a mock turtleneck. I sent that back because I don't do those. But I was on the fence of this Pilsen thermal white long sleeve shirt because it's a little bit of a throwback for me back in my salad days as a slacker. Now I'm wearing the thing like 4 days a week. I know it's not. And when I'm not like in my show uniform, I'm wearing it constantly. So I got to get new. It's just weird. It occurred to me today, like I wasn't sure about this. And now it's like literally my favorite piece of clothing. I don't wear any other piece of clothing. But you can get started today at stitchfix.com/majority. You'll get 25% off when you keep everything in your fix. That's stitchfix.com/majority for 25% off when you keep everything in your fix. stitchfix.com/majority. And lastly, one of the things I also have done over COVID is make sure that I am taking vitamins because I want to remain healthy. I want to try and come on the other side of this, not, completely depleted. Well, you deserve to know what you're putting in your bodies and why, especially when it comes to taking something every day. Ritual's clean, vegan-friendly multivitamin formulated with high-quality nutrients in bioavailable forms your body can actually use. There are no shady extras. Ritual's delayed release capsule design delivers high quality nutrients, including vitamin D3 in just 2 daily pills. That is the big, every time I go see my doctor, he's always like, you are deficient in vitamin D. Well, you'll always know what nutrients you're taking and where they come from, thanks to Ritual's one of a kind visible supply chain. In other words, you go to the site and they will tell you where everything in that vitamin comes from. Now available for women, men, and teens, Ritual multivitamins are scientifically developed to help support different life stages. Your multivitamins are delivered to your door every month with free shipping, and that's the other thing. Can I tell you how many times I have bought a bottle of multivitamins, taken them, done a good job about being disciplined about taking them every day, it runs out, and then I forget. Boom. Well, now you don't have to worry about it because they're delivered to your door every month. Reminds you, take them. You can start, snooze, or cancel your subscription anytime. Super easy. If you don't love Ritual within your first month, they'll refund your first order. Like I say, for me, I forget to do these things. I'm not terribly disciplined about this stuff. The monthly thing reminds me to not let it wane because you got to get into a habit. It takes 30 days to develop this type of like habit, they say. For me, it takes like, I don't know, 15 years. And even then. But that's what I like about it for Ritual. I mean, that's... I mean, I've never really been on a vitamin regime as much before. So
you mean regimen?
It is great. Huh?
You mean regimen?
Yeah. Regime, regiment. Okay.
All right. Well,
either
I mean,
one.
I just,
it's not going to necessarily change my addiction, but yeah, you might be right.
The king of vitamins?
Anyways, you get key nutrients without the BS with Ritual. Ritual's offering my listeners 10% off during your first 3 months. Visit ritual.com/majority. Start your Ritual today. You can check out the supply lines. Really interesting. All right. Don't forget, your support makes this show possible. If you become a member today at jointhemajorityreport.com, you not only get the free show, you get it commercial free. And you get the fun half every day. Jointhemajorityreport.com. All right. Quick break. And then we'll be back with Naomi Klein. We're back, Sam Seder, on the Majority Report on the Zoom. It is a pleasure to welcome back to the program Naomi Klein. She's a senior correspondent at The Intercept. She's also the Gloria Steinem Endowed Chair at Rutgers University. Her new book, How to Change Everything, The Young Human's Guide to Protecting the Planet and Each Other, will be published tomorrow. And she'll be launching the book at the Brooklyn Public Library virtually. Virtually.
In other words, I'll just be sitting in this chair.
As it's too bad, too, because I would have loved to have actually physically gone. But and you'll be in conversation with the Sunrise New York City Youth and Tocada Iron Eyes from Standing Rock tonight at 6 p.m. Eastern. Folks can check that out at the brooklynlibrary.org. It's B-K-L-Y-N. I don't know why they couldn't spell out Brooklyn. But Naomi Klein, welcome. We're here, of course, with Emma Vigeland. And I wanted to talk about specifically your piece in the Times today because it had occurred to me. I was on vacation last week. And as I was watching this, it occurred to me that I was not hearing the classic, we shouldn't politicize this. Mm-hmm. And your piece really sort of made it clear why.
Yeah, no. Well, great to be with you, Sam and Emma. Yeah, no, there was this symphony of voices from the Republican side, clearly a coordinated talking point that they were going to get out of the gate and politicize the hell out of this with blaming the Green New Deal, blaming renewable energy. They had all of their memes ready with frozen wind turbines and snow-covered solar panels. And it was just like, you know, just within a couple of hours, we were hearing it from Greg Abbott, Rick Perry, Ted Cruz. They were all, you know, pounding the same drum. And I think that, you know, it's very clear why. I think they're terrified of a Green New Deal, which actually has the potential to solve many of Texas's huge intersecting overlapping problems, which is the whole point of a Green New Deal. So, you know, they had to deflect right out of the gate.
It was a fact. And I, we'll circle back to this, but it was just fascinating to see. And I think, you know, one of the things I really want to touch on that is this notion that in your piece about having these ideas, having ideas at the ready for a crisis. I mean, of course, I can't imagine, or I should hope that we don't have too many people watching us who haven't read The Shock Doctrine by now. But we were also just, you know, before we started recording, we were talking about your piece that you and I discussed 17 years ago.
When we were young.
A little scary about year zero and referencing Baghdad. Just, I mean, explain just for a moment,
just to be clear, like that piece, there was a piece that came out in Harper's in 2004, and it was called Baghdad Year Zero, Pillaging Iraq in Pursuit of a Neocon Utopia. And that was the sort of piece that turned into The Shock Doctrine. That was my kind of, I guess, my wake up call about this is a kind of this is what I thought at the time was a new tactic of harnessing the power of shock and trauma. In that case, the shock and awe military invasion of Iraq, that was how it was branded, to push through so-called economic shock therapy, to use this kind of window of opportunity that opens up in the aftermath of a hugely traumatic event to do things you would not be able to do otherwise. So what I was reporting on for Harper's was this push to sell off all of Iraq's state-owned industries, to roll back labor protections. I mean, not to say Saddam Hussein's Iraq was some socialist utopia, but it did have some protections for workers, and it did prevent foreign investors from coming into the country and buying up state-owned industries. And so that was what the Bush administration was determined to do in that window of opportunity. And in the process, they actually ignited a very forceful Iraqi resistance, and the rest is history.
Have they almost kind of perfected this too? I mean, the level of coordination that we've seen, like it's almost like they use, as you cite in your piece, Katrina, Iraq, all of these other past disasters as a trial run, and the machine is so well oiled. You had the Wall Street Journal and Breitbart within hours come out with this anti-green energy push in terms of messaging. Then, of course, Fox followed. And then really, I think Abbott, Cruz, Dan Patrick, they were going on Fox News regurgitating their own talking points. So it's almost as if they have it down to a science at this point.
Yeah, but I think we're getting kind of meta here, because what we're seeing with attacking the Green New Deal is not what I've described as the Shock Doctrine. I mean, the Shock Doctrine is using the window to push through privatization, deregulation, austerity, the whole neoliberal playbook, right? The problem is in Texas, they've already implemented the entire playbook, and that is what produced the crisis. And what they're terrified of is that the reality of the effects of their policies will spur a progressive response to disaster. And, you know, in the Shock Doctrine, I go back and really look at the origins of the strategy and, you know, exploiting crisis is not a new idea. I mean, Machiavelli talks about it. But I'm talking about this within the context of neoliberal history.
Right.
And I often quote Milton Friedman in an essay he wrote in 1982 for an anniversary edition of Capitalism and Freedom, where he says, only a crisis, actual or perceived, produces real change. When the crisis occurs, the change depends on the ideas that are lying around. That's a key word, lying around. And he says, that, I believe, is our basic function. And here he's talking about not just right-wing economists, but the whole infrastructure of right-wing think tanks that he was intimately connected to. Cato, American Enterprise Institute, Heritage. Get your ideas ready. Store them like canned goods and toilet paper for when the disaster hits, and then you pounce, right? And what's interesting about that is that Friedman was obsessed with the New Deal. And he believed that everything went wrong when the market crash happened in 1929. People saw the cruelties of this economic system, both the instability and its willingness to allow so many people to fall into such desperate poverty. And that was the shock that brought about what Friedman hated more than anything else, which was the original New Deal. And I quote him in a letter he wrote to Augusto Pinochet in the 70s, saying that history took a wrong turn, he says, in your country, as well as mine, in the 1930s, when people got the idea that they could do good with other people's money. So what they are terrified of is that their shock doctrine strategy has been tried, failed. Their ideas aren't lying around. They're lying in ruin. And they're afraid of another New Deal. They're afraid of the Green New Deal. They're afraid that we're the ones with the ideas now to actually solve the real problems. And that actually gives me some hope. You know, I mean, I think that's interesting. It's very different.
All right. So let's go backwards just a little bit, because you mentioned Pinochet, and it was the first thing that you know, because I think when we spoke in 2004, I don't know if we used the term neoliberal, frankly. I mean, it's possible. And when we're talking about this type of neoliberalism, we are talking very sort of almost strict definitional Mount Pelerin type of stuff, where there was a specific agenda set out following World War II to make sure that something like the New Deal doesn't happen again.
Yeah.
Maybe it was 30 years, basically, until you get to Chile, where they had the opportunity. They build up these ideas, and there's their opportunity to deploy it. I mean, I think Iraq was probably the next sort of biggest single moment where they had that opportunity again, which was to implement, you know, to really sort of like really lay this project out. And it's
well, there were other ones in between, you know, like the collapse of the former Soviet Union, like other right. major shocks, right, which create this kind of blank slate, a state, or what they imagine to be a blank slate. You know, whenever anyone uses that phrase, blank slate, blank sheet, you know, that's when you need to be very afraid. But yeah, they were ready, not just with the ideas, but with the people. This was really important, right? As far as Latin America was concerned. In Latin America, they talk about the Chicago Boys being the economists who worked with Milton, who worked with Pinochet and other dictatorships to impose these radical privatizations. That was only possible because there was a 20-year process at the University of Chicago where hundreds of young economic students were brought from different parts of the world, but particularly Latin America, hundreds of young Latin American economists to be trained under Friedman and other far-right economists. It was originally funded by the State Department, then it was funded by the Ford Foundation. And so when that shock came, they had their personnel ready. You know, Pinochet had the guns, but it was the Chicago Boys who wrote what was called the brick, which was this very thick manual for what they should do with the economy immediately after the coup.
And so we have now sort of almost gone full circle where they have had the opportunity to, and particularly in Texas, to implement these things. And it's sort of like the dog that catches the car, right? and this, their the front of their face is now smashed in because they've run out of these ideas. I mean,
how desperate do you have to be in Texas to claim that the Green New Deal produced this? I mean, Texas is as far from the Green New Deal as you could possibly imagine. It's a petrostate, right? Yes, they have some wind turbines, but the vast majority of their energy comes from gas and coal. It was that infrastructure that froze up because of the, you know, you have the collision of fossil fuels, successful decades of deregulation, not telling the fossil fuel companies that they need to winterize, telling them that they didn't need to do anything to prepare for a crisis. They just needed to maximize their profits and do whatever it took to make the most money in the short term. And then you have climate disruption, which is intimately linked to this ideology, because the reason we have failed to act in the face of knowing about this crisis and decades of expert testimony before Congress is that this crisis lands on our lap, right? And this is what my book, This Changes Everything, was about. the, you know, James Hansen testifies before Congress, the country's leading climate expert, and says in 1988 that he can now say with, I think he said, 99 degree certainty that humans were causing the planet, the planet's climate to change. This is 1988, the worst possible moment for this to happen. It's the year before the Berlin Wall collapses. Francis Fukuyama is about to declare history over. Right. Margaret Thatcher has said there is no alternative. It's the high point of the free market revolution. And that is a disaster when it comes to climate change, because if we're going to take this crisis seriously, we have to regulate corporations. We have to hold on to the levers of power within our states, including control over energy, and not just hand it over to the free market, because we need to get to renewable energy in a hurry. You know, we have to question all the fundamentals. And of course, we need to invest in the public sphere, which is exactly what they're telling us we can't do. So Texas is in this kind of, like, overused phrase, but a perfect storm of all of these crises born of the successful implementation of these policies hitting all at once.
I'm trying to look back over the past 20 years where we had similar moments like this that did not create the panic that I think we have seen from these Republicans out of Texas over the past week that Emma just described as a sort of like coordinated response that was born out of panic, right? Because there you can't go to the well. There's no other, you can't redeploy what has already been deployed there. And I'm looking at, you can, but not so much in Texas. Like, you can't say, like, we're going to double up on, we need to have
never
more.
Say never, Sam. They can always make things worse.
At least they didn't feel confident they could. No. Right. I mean, and so, right. But I'm thinking like the financial crisis, which they didn't have the same panic that came from that in the same way. I'm thinking Kansas, where they had the opportunity to implement the supply side economics, like the tax cutting, you know, the whole Laffer curve, the idea that this is going to increase revenues, and it failed miserably. I'm thinking austerity in 2010, that was, you know, it failed even worse in Europe because it was implemented more.
Right.
But there wasn't the same sort of like, this is just so naked, their panic.
Right.
And what do you attribute that to?
So what I attribute it to is the presence of an alternative political program, which is really what is different than previous shocks that have exposed the failures of this economic project. You know, I think about Katrina, 2005. Once again, a collision of heavy weather of the kind that we are seeing more and more of that link to climate change, slamming headlong into a deliberately neglected, austerity-starved public sphere, overlaid with systemic racism and white supremacy. And so you have the storm slamming into the levees that there had been years of warnings, repair them, they're crumbling, ignored. The levees break, they breach. Fox News is talking about people being looters when they're actually just trying to get water and food. They're talking about animals in the Superdome, and it's just people trying to survive. People are abandoned for days. You remember FEMA couldn't seem to find New Orleans for 5 days.
It had been fully privatized, not fully, but it had been extremely privatized after one of, and Bill Clinton, there's not a lot of times I say positive things about Bill Clinton, but FEMA under Bill Clinton had been built up significantly. And under George W. Bush, it had been privatized rather quickly.
Privatized and handed to totally inept cronies. Remember Michael Brown? I mean, it was one of those moments. And in the shock doctrine, and I did this again in the New York Times piece, I quoted all of these are free market zealots who suddenly lost their religion, looking at what it actually means to have no government. All the people who took so much delight in talking about, you know, drowning the government in the bathtub. Jonah Goldberg was saying, okay, where's the government? In a crisis, you actually want the government to saddle up, was his phrase. You had neocons talking about how the fall of New Orleans levees was going to be for Reaganism what the collapse of the Berlin Wall was for Soviet communism, because it revealed its failures. And so a lot of us, there was a moment there when that happened, that a lot of us thought, okay, this is going to be the moment, and there is going to be a rejection, and there is going to be an alternative. But what there wasn't back in 2005 was a broad-based social movement that had a vision for what the next economy should look like, you know, and that vision is best encapsulated in the phrase, the Green New Deal, which is not one policy. It's a host of policies. It's a vision for fighting climate change and racism and every kind of inequality and getting off fossil fuels within a decade. And so that we didn't have that in 2005. And so in the absence of having our own ideas lying around, to use Milton Friedman's phrase, they just went in there and they went further. They privatized the school system. They demolished public housing. That's why I say, don't say, never say never. There's right. always more public sector to destroy. There's always more that can be privatized. There's always more ways to take a crisis that was created by elites and hand it over to people who can't take it anymore. We saw it in Europe after the financial crisis. They are panicked because finally the stranglehold that the neoliberal project has had over the progressive imagination for 40 years is loosened enough that we aren't just saying, no, this is terrible, stop it. We actually have our alternatives, and they are ready to go.
And do you think part of what increases their panic as well is the fact that those alternatives are a part of, I guess, you know, you could capitalize on that. There is profit to be had on the other end in the alternative, as opposed to what we saw in Katrina or in the financial collapse, where that was just more regulation on existing markets, as opposed to tearing down an economy or not just tearing down an economy, but bringing new profit sectors to an anemic American economy. Like, that's part of also why I think, you know, maybe Democrats are more willing to accept some of these ideas too, more traditional Democrats who would have been more amenable to a neoliberal project, say, 10 years ago. Does that make sense?
I think, well, look, there's money to be made in renewables, which is why that's why there's wind power in Texas, right? I mean, a not insignificant amount of wind power. It's not the reason the power went out, but it's around 20% of the grid. So I don't think it's so much about whether there are markets in this or whether there are markets, but I think you're absolutely right, Emma, that I think that there's support for these policies or some parts of these policies in the Democratic Party establishment. Because absolutely, this renewable energy is a growth sector. You can create a lot of jobs. But I think what Texas shows is that it isn't just about having a renewable energy market. It has to be regulated. I personally think it needs to be in public hands. I think we need energy democracy. I mean, and public doesn't mean like one big state power sector. In Germany, they have hundreds of cities and towns that have remunicipalized their power grids in order to get to 100% renewable energy, because private players wanted to do it, but they wanted to do it more slowly. And we have to do it so fast that it might not be profitable in the short term. And we have to be honest about that. I think that there's a lot of sort of happy talk about how, you know, this is all going to be great and growth and jobs and so on. And there are going to be jobs and it is possible to do, but there are also going to be some players who lose a lot of money in this process. And so, you know, coming back to your point, in Texas, yeah, it's a petro state. And so there's not going to be the same kind. Renewable energy is a sector where you can create a lot of money, but it lends itself to decentralization in a way that fossil fuels don't, right? And this is, I think, a really key point. fossil fuels, by their very nature, they're buried in the ground, okay, in specific places. So you have to spend a lot of money to dig it up, and then you need to spend a lot of money to transport it and process it. And because of those very, very costly, just necessary for running it, right, just sunk costs, that lends itself to monopolies or just a few big players. You're not going to have a mom and pop fossil fuel operation, right? Whereas renewable energy, if you're talking about wind and solar, it's everywhere. So it's decentralized by its very nature. And so what that means is that, yes, people can make money, but you're going to have many players making less money. And so a political structure that, like Texas and like the Republican Party generally, that is built kind of around an oligarchic power, right? You have a few big players, and those big players fund up a whole political operation. They are very invested in keeping that level of centralization and are very threatened by a model which says, hey, you can put solar panels on your rooftop and become a competitor to your local utility. So your customer becomes your competitor. That's no fun. That gives you way less power, right? Political power and economic power.
And more actual power. I would add to that. I just, spoke with Andreas Malm. I don't know if you're familiar with him. A Swede who's just written a book, How to Blow Up a Pipeline. I should say it's not a specific manual. But he had written a book.
Fossil Capital.
Fossil Capital, which makes that very point. And on some level, you have the investor class. They invest in this huge apparatus to get the oil out of the ground. They are looking at 10x, 100x more in terms of returns on that fossil fuel. On some level, there's an analogy between the investment that in returns that people expect from, let's say, a cable news program versus this one. A bunch of these combined might be able to generate the same amount of revenue, but in terms of an investor class, the returns are just simply not going to be there.
Right.
That's why they're going to fight this. And ultimately we can't rely on the profit motive or incentive to, this isn't one of those sort of like clash of titans where you have.
And it's often why you'll have, there's a big lobby that's pushing really hard for nuclear, right? And it spends a lot of time lying about renewables and claiming that they're not efficient, that it's not possible to have the kind of backup power, which of course we can have with battery power. And I've tried to understand, like, why is it? Why are they so invested in pushing nuclear, which obviously has way more risks than renewables? And we know what those are. And I think it's because it's more of a one-to-one substitution, right? Nuclear has the same sort of ownership structure as fossil fuels, ton of money to get it out and process it. And it lends itself, once again, to a few big players that are going to make a hell of a lot of money. And it doesn't challenge that sort of concentrated either economic power or political power in the same way that renewables do.
We should add that the production, when you talk about nuclear, you're also talking about sort of long-term financing. The production of energy with renewables, once you've done the initial investment on the infrastructure, it's hard to sort of like, to juice the profits there because you've done all the heavy lifting, at that point in terms of the generation of the energy. Once you've built the panels or the windmills, that's just happening at that point. All right.
You don't have to keep, rebuying your input.
Exactly.
Yeah. And that, as Andreas Malm's research shows, that made fossil fuels a hard sell originally. Among industrialists in Europe who were saying, well, why would I continuously rebuy coal when I'm currently getting my power from water? They had these huge water wheels that were actually more powerful than coal power at the time. And Malm makes the argument that the appeal of fossil fuels was the power that it gave to factory owners to move their factories wherever they wanted and find the cheapest, most controllable labor. That it's always really been about power and not about electricity kind of power, political power.
Yeah. Well, so let me ask you this. So the neoliberal project had the ability to have these ideas on the shelves, right? Like, you know, and through Cato Heritage, through you know, I mean, on and on. They built an infrastructure that was able to sustain itself without responding to events in any given moment, right? Like we have, and like you say, in 2005, there was no infrastructure on the, you know, nominal left to respond to these crises with ideas. How do we sustain that?
It was very reactive. Yeah. You had local groups trying to fight a demolition,
How do we sustain a basically like, you know, I mean, to use an analogy with what we saw in Texas,
yeah,
there was no regulation to have extra capacity in the system, right? It was relied upon these private actors. You guys, you're making so much money that you're going to reinvest to have extra capacity. Well, why would we? When that would be, you know, just in reserves, why would we do that? And they didn't. Regulation that we have in other places in the country.
They also just don't care, Sam.
They don't care. They don't care because there's no incentive.
Ted Cruz flying off to Cancun. It's sure. This is like a metaphor for how these guys actually think, which is that they're going to be fine.
Exactly.
And when the shit hits the fan, they are getting on a plane and leaving. Their wealth and power will protect them. This is really important to understand about Republicans and so-called climate deniers. They know climate change is real. They think they're going to be fine. That is why they feel free to play games.
And these energy companies know that they can get, you know, Abbott to jump on TV and say it's the Green New Deal so that they're not going to, you know, have to go back into some type of regulatory regime. They'll ride it out in 6 months.
They'll get bailed out.
Yeah, exactly. And so, but how do we develop a sustainable movement without the resources that the right has to, like, you know, because I'm just thinking about back when we had our first conversation, there was a blogosphere and there was a lot of people. It was a new technology. A lot of people were going on. They were doing this as amateurs. But over time, you know, when George Bush went away and there wasn't the urgency and the immediacy in that moment, there was nothing to sustain their voices, and all of that just sort of evaporated. Some went into, you know, sort of more institutional work, but it dissipated. Mm-hmm. How do we prevent any type of dissipation when it's that much harder to maintain? You know, I mean, we have people who are very, but it's hard to maintain this unless, like, you have resources,
right? And you have to have that kind of discipline. To have your plan and push your plan when there are openings. And so we are in better shape than we were in 2005 or 2008 when the financial crisis happened and you had, you know, Occupy Wall Street eventually, but you didn't have a set of clear demands about, okay, well, what do we want instead of this failed system? So we are in a better place than we were. We have the squad. We have key policy planks that we're pushing for. We've had two Bernie Sanders presidential campaigns that have put these ideas solidly on the map, whether it is canceling student debt, whether it's free college, whether it's Medicare for all, whether it's ending mass incarceration, defunding the police, moving that money over to a Green New Deal. We have made a lot of progress in terms of those affirmative demands and having an affirmative vision. You know, like I said in the piece, after Katrina, there was no squad, there was no Sunrise Movement, the climate justice movement was nascent at that point. So we've done a lot of work and we need to give ourselves credit that, you know, there has been progress. DSA, was a few thousand people. It was not the sort of political force that it is now. Justice Democrats didn't exist. There is infrastructure on the left that has been taking ideas seriously, investing in ideas, investing in vision, not just issues, right? This is the problem that we had a right that was deeply funded in its worldview. Milton Friedman represented a worldview, a vision for what the world should look like, a terrible vision, but a vision, a dangerous vision, but a vision. And then you had liberal foundations that were funding narrow issues. You know, these people will work on environment. These people will work fighting racism. These people will work for gender equality. But there was not a vision for what the world should actually look like, because frankly, that was threatening to these liberal foundations, a lot of them, who weren't interested in that kind of deep change. They wanted kind of band-aids. So there has been a shift. That is why they're going after the Green New Deal. It represents a thawing of that frozen imagination, and that, you know, that was really successful in the Reagan-Thatcher project of saying, you are not allowed to talk about alternatives. There is no alternative. You can critique what we're doing and say you don't like it, but that is different from saying we actually have a different plan for what the economy should look like. And I think I think they're telling on themselves by going after the Green New Deal as hard as they are. I think that's a hint that this is really where we need to do more work. We need to invest more in that sort of idea infrastructure. We need movements cooperating more on that holistic vision. And we just need to stay the course, frankly, because I think we're in better shape than we've been in a long time. I know that seems like a weird thing to say at such a dire moment in Texas, but the fact that they are going after the Green New Deal means they're terrified that the left is the ones that have alternatives that can speak to where people are at. I mean, Abbott is a monster. He evicted thousands of people from their tents in places like Austin just to get them out of the way, you know, a year ago. And then the pandemic hits, and now this, you know, these weather shocks of the kind that we're going to see more and more of in a warming world, in a destabilized climate, they've got nothing to offer to people. And people need real solutions. They are in pain. And that is the kind of conditions that won the original New Deal. And that is what's scaring them.
What is the next step mechanically? I mean, it's one thing to say, like, keep going on in this way, but let me rephrase that. Is there
Hard on Biden.
I think that's across the board. I think that mm-hmm. that is, but is there a specific next step, or is it like all of the above and see which works?
I think that we need to be investing in that intellectual architecture. We need to be taking it seriously. We need ways of funding it that aren't dependent on liberal foundations that are never actually going to believe in it. I think we are seeing the power of the squad, and we need to keep enlarging the squad. And so, you know, looking forward to the next midterms, you know, we need to be thinking about that. I think we've made some progress, and I think that there never should have been a honeymoon with Biden. I think he was better than we expected out of the gate, but now what we're seeing is that Biden is Biden.
Right.
and he is not our friend, frankly. I mean, if you want a Green New Deal, Biden's not your friend. He's co-opted a lot of the discourse, but when it comes to doing the really hard things that involve standing up to donors, we cannot rely on him. And so this moment where it is so clear to people that small sort of tinkering solutions are not the fit for our era of big overlapping and intersecting crises, that is the moment where we need to be pushing as hard as we possibly can, because no, he's not FDR. I mean, FDR wasn't FDR before he was FDR, but Biden isn't FDR.
Well, he's not LBJ either, which is the loftiest hope. He's not that either.
Yeah. So, I mean, we're in better shape, but we're not where we should be. We're not where we could be. And that's why there's a lot of sad Bernie friends thinking about Nevada. right, this time last year. My last happy day 1 year ago when we won Nevada.
Oh, yeah. I was in Vegas. I won money there. That's a rarity, too. You know, that doesn't happen often.
Well, I mean, I think that's a good place to end. I mean, I think, you know,
just
one
sad
of the other
Bernie emojis.
Yes. Well, I mean, there's actually one other thing that occurs to me, too, that I think is interesting about this, the Green New Deal phenomena is that it feels like, and this is early in this new era, but it feels like that bankruptcy that you're talking about in terms of a response has also had a structural implication for the turf that Republicans are fighting on. Like, you know, there is no, you cannot, you know, even in the context of this $1.9 trillion COVID relief bill that the House is, I think, scheduled to pass this week. They're in the middle of committee markup, and then it's going to go to the Senate, and we're going to get that. The what's in it isn't necessarily all the things that we want, but the voices of austerity, the voices that I would have anticipated a year ago, if I didn't know that this was going to happen, I would have said there would have been the Republicans are going to come out and they're going to talk about like the deficit and the debt and this and that, and they don't even seem to be engaging in that. It is, they're immediately sort of moving into a different silo, almost like a different playing field where it's like, we can't even pretend anymore about the whole deficit debt thing or the austerity thing. It really, the issue is like, I think they're sort of, you know, flopping around for what it is, but it's going to be something more cultural, and they're not even engaging. There's no Paul Ryan to pretend that like, oh, I'm thoughtful about that. They don't even seem to be engaging in that. And I think, I mean, A, is that your sense as well? And B, if it is, that is even more of an opportunity for those of us to put some real ideas into the discourse.
It is. I mean, I agree entirely that there is a sort of an eerie silence on the deficit front. It doesn't mean it won't come back. But I think the pandemic is a pretty tough time to be playing austerity politics. It can always get worse, though. And however it comes back, I mean, you know, you say cultural. Look, I think, you know, even when it comes just to climate, one of the, you know, we often talk about how do we convince climate change deniers, right? One of the scarier prospects is what happens when people on the far right stop denying the reality of climate change. And then they just have this sort of unmasked eco-fascism, which far right parties in Europe have fully embraced, like Marine Le Pen in France. She's not a climate denier. She fully says climate change is happening, and that is why we have to lock down the borders, protect our own. And this was very kind of alive in the bloodstream in Texas. When you think about the El Paso massacre in the Walmart a little more than a year ago, this was a shooter who was inspired by the New Zealand mass shooting at the two mosques. That was a self-described eco-fascist. The guy who, I mean, I don't use their names, but in El Paso, he went to Walmart, he said, because he realized that if brown people start consuming the way Americans do, then the planet is destroyed. So he went to Walmart, a Walmart that is frequented by Mexican Americans and by Mexicans coming across the border, to basically say, you're not allowed to shop like us. Right. So when we say it's going to come back and it's cultural, I mean, it's monstrous. The cultural form of this is really monstrous, not to say that it isn't monstrous now. But yeah, things can always get worse, which is all the more reason why we need to be very clear about how we respond to climate change, massive inequality, systemic racism, all at the same time. And that's called the Green New Deal.
Naomi Klein, your new book, I think, as you're aware, How to Change Everything, The Young Human Guides to Protecting the Planet and Each Other, is going to be released tomorrow. And tonight at 6 p.m., you can check out Naomi at a virtual book launching at the Brooklyn Public Library. We will put a link to that. It's BicklinLibrary.org. I don't know why they just couldn't do the whole Brooklyn, but we will put a link to that at majority.fm and in the podcast and YouTube description. Thank you so much, Naomi. Really appreciate it. Always great to talk to you.
Thank you, Sam. Thanks, Emma. Take care.
Thanks so much. Bye.
Bye.
All right, folks, quick break. We'll be right back. Okay, and just wrapping up things here. You know, as she was saying at the end there, Emma, about this notion of eco-fascism, I am reminded of the mayor, I can't remember which town it was in Texas, saying, putting out on, I think it was on Facebook or something, like, you got to take care of yourselves. Like, we're, you know, stop relying on the government to do this. Like, this sort of sense of total individualism in the face of an issue like, you know, and I remember seeing somebody, I think it was on Twitter, putting up a picture of their wood stove and their wood next to it in their house. That's all well and good, unless you live in an apartment building or unless you don't have a wood stove.
Yeah, and 60% of heating is electrical in Texas. So, I mean, yeah, I guess you can just pull yourself up by your bootstraps and create your own electrical lines. I mean, that's what the response is going to be from conservatives. As these climate-related catastrophes ramp up, it's going to be more personal responsibility rhetoric as opposed to, you know, addressing or reckoning with the fact that they created the conditions that wrecked so much infrastructure because of their own greed and lack of foresight.
And let's be clear where that sort of, you know, pull yourself up by the bootstraps rhetoric heads towards, right? Like, we're going to protect our own. I'm going to protect my family and you protect yours. You know, maybe you do it by going to Cancun or not, but I'm going to protect my family. And that sort of individualism is the sort of building block of that type of eco-fascism, right? That notion of we've got to edify our borders and we're going to prepare so that we survive the climate upheaval, as opposed to necessarily other people. Like that, I mean, that is...
Well, they walk hand in hand, the us versus them and the bootstraps.
Exactly. And so people should be aware of that rhetoric as it comes up. It's not just a question of, you know, you got to be kidding me, dude. Like, you're saying the solution to the grid failure is for everybody to go back and pretend like it's, you know, 1835. No, the solution of the grid failure is to have a central government that is responsible for the grid so that job number one is not profits. Job number one is getting people electricity. And that is you know, we'll see. I think.
And it needs to be reckoned with in other states that have, you know, basically corporation types that monopolize electrical grids and power systems. It's not just a Texas problem, although it's acute there.
Indeed. All right. We'll have more to talk about this and more on tomorrow's program. Till then, we will say adieu, right? Is that what I want to say?
Yeah, good job.
Bye, y'all. How's that?
Yeah, you know, you really pull off the Southern drawl well.
I was supposed to be more like Texas.
Right?
Yep. And for those of you sticking around, we will be heading into the fun half in just a moment. First, let me just remind you, Hunt a Killer. It's the murder mystery subscription box. That's the most exciting date night you can have at home. Hunt a Killer brings people together by challenging them to decode ciphers, examine clues, you solve puzzles. It's like an escape room delivered right to your door. And nobody's going to an escape room now, I can tell you that. Right now, you can go to huntakiller.com/majority. Use the promo code MAJORITY for 20% off your first box. Again, make sure you use code MAJORITY for 20% off. Just a reminder, it's your support that makes this show possible. You can become a member at jointhemajorityreport.com. Don't forget justcoffee.coop, fair trade coffee, tea, or chocolate. Use the coupon code MAJORITY, get 10% off. They got a bunch of new flavors of coffee. Blends? What do you call that? Yeah, blends, not flavors. Blends and roasts. Check it out, justcoffee.coop. Also, don't forget AM Quickie every morning. Available, I don't know, basically before you wake up, unless you got kids, in which case it probably comes out shortly after you wake up. But you can check that out, amquickie.com or wherever you get your podcasts. Jamie.
Hello.
I haven't seen you since your vacation. Oh, yes, we have. Or I haven't seen you since mine. What's happening on the Antifada?
Well, this week on the Antifada, we speak with Matt and Imbogue from the local, well, local to us, Radical Community Center, Woodbine Space, about the new Adam Curtis series that came out on the BBC. We had a lot of different opinions on it. Some of us took a more radical message from it. Some of us thought it was maybe even a little anti-communist, a little idealist, shall we say. So we had like a spirited back and forth about that. And that will be coming out on Wednesday and Friday, because there was so much of it that we got a bonus too. Patreon.com/TheAntifada. Also, our episode from last week with Left Flank Vets is still good. If you haven't listened to it yet, you want to learn about openings for socialist organizing in the military. What? Check that out. And also watch us on our Twitch channel, twitch.tv/TheAntifada. We're streaming really four nights a week now, if you count the night that Sean plays video games, talks about stuff. We had a really fun ladies' night last Thursday. That's a new show that I'm doing all by myself on Thursdays. Oh, my God. And the VOD is still up if anyone wants to watch, you know, Antifada After Dark, shall we say. And that's going to be happening every week. Twitch.tv/TheAntifada, 7 p.m. Eastern.
I watched a couple of those Adam Curtis, it's a 6-part series, right? Mm-hmm. And I watched a couple. I like it. I mean, I find the different sort of like historical stories fascinating. There's a little bit of like, if you start with a theme, I think you can find it anywhere. If you you can find it in history, you can find any theme you want in history. I find it fascinating, and I think they're well done, but I'm not sure I necessarily buy the premise yet, but we'll see.
Yeah. Well, I enjoyed it as well. Apparently he really brings it together at the end. I fell asleep before the very end part because his voice is very soothing to me. So I'm going to need to go back and watch it, but I enjoy his movies. I think they're cool.
I do too.
I'm just not sure if they necessarily agree with my politics. Although, according to Sean, his sort of weird idealist analysis of history and psychosocial crises can exist alongside a Marxist analysis. So there you go.
There you go. I'm envious that you're able to fall asleep with noise in the background. I'm a terrible sleeper. Double earplugs, white noise machine, and fan necessary for me.
Wow. That's a lot of white noise.
Mm-hmm.
A fan and a noise machine?
Well, you know, it depends. I have somebody who my new neighbor is clearly a musician.
Oh, boy. Oh, boy. No, like a soft-voiced British man. I don't know what it is. It's like ambient to me. Like, I still don't know anything about Gothic architecture because I had a professor like that in college. And as soon as he turned on the lights and started putting slides up, talking about Gothic architecture, it was like, mm-mm, can't stay awake.
Yeah, that does sound specifically designed to put people to sleep.
Folks, you can check out what's going on in the Matt Leckian universe, Left Reckoning. Find it on YouTube and on wherever your podcasts are served. I imagine he's doing some work this week. He's technically on vacation, but you know how Matt is. There's probably a lot of streaming video going on with video games. All right, going to take a quick break. Head into the fun half, 646-257-3920. See you there.
In for it.
All right, folks, 646-257-3920. See you in the fun half.
Are you ready?
Who sent us this?
Anarchy. Alpha males are back. Back, 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 back. Boy is back. And the alpha males are back. Back.
Just as delicious as you can imagine.
The alpha males are back, 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 boy, back. And the alpha males are back, 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 back.
Just want to degrade the white man.
Alpha males are back, back.
I take all of it in my throat.
Alpha males are back, 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 back.
Almost as what?
The alpha males are back.